Monitor brings you Meet the Press, the prize-winning interview program produced by Lawrence E. Spivak. Ready for the spontaneous, unrehearsed conference are four of America's top news reporters. Their questions do not necessarily reflect their point of view, but may be their way of getting a story for you. Now here is the moderator of Meet the Press, Ned Brooks.
Welcome once again to Meet the Press. The dramatic performance of the weather satellite Tyros, now circling the Earth, has again focused world attention on the extraordinary possibilities of space exploration. Our guest today is the head of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, Dr. Keith Glennon. His agency was set up 18 months ago to conduct research and development of a program for the peaceful use of outer space. One of his top priority projects is the Mercury program, for sending the first man into space. He was awarded the Medal of Merit. He served for 2 years as a member of the Atomic Energy Commission. Dr. Glennon is now on leave from the presidency of Case Institute of Technology of Cleveland, a position he has held since 1947. And now seated around the press table, ready to interview Dr. Glennon, are Peter Hackus of NBC News, William Hines of the Washington Evening Star, John Finney of the New York Times, and Lawrence E. Spivak, our regular member of the Meet the Press panel. Now, Dr. Glennon, if you're ready, we'll start the questions with Mr. Spivak.
Dr. Glennon, there are many people in this country who believe that unless we outstrip the Soviet Union in the exploration and exploitation of space, we could, as a nation, face destruction. Do you?
I don't. Mr. Spivak, I don't feel that the space business is the only business in which this nation must win a competitive advantage with the Russians.
Dr. Glennon, you yourself at one time said that Russia's head start in the space race, I think these were your words, represents a real threat to our security. Now, what did you mean by that?
I don't recall, Mr. Spivak, having made that statement, but I would think that if I did make it, and you say I did, that what I really meant was that unless we got on with the business of developing the scientific and technological know-how which we have in this country and putting it to very good use, we could fall behind in a variety of fields of technology, and this we would not want to do.
Well, I'm only raising the question of what would happen if the Russians beat us in space. I'm not suggesting that they're going to. I want to know how serious that would be. Men like von Braun, for example, have said that we would be in mortal danger if the Russians first gained control of outer space. And this is the question I'm asking. Do you think that we would be in mortal danger if the Russians did beat us? I'm not saying that they have or will.
I don't think we'd be in mortal danger if the Russians gained control of outer space. I'd put it the other way, Mr. Spivak. I think the nation which is the leader on Earth is going to control outer space. I don't believe myself that the control of outer space for military purposes, such as the launching of missiles or anything of that sort, is a probability in the very near future, and thus I can't say that I would consider that the United States was in mortal danger if we did not control outer space.
You say the nation that was the leader on Earth will control outer space? What do you mean by that?
I mean that the strong nation on Earth is undoubtedly the nation which will be first in outer space.
Well, but the question I come back to is not whether we're going to be the first there, but how serious would it be if we were not there?
I think it would be serious in the sense that it would mean that our total technology had, in essence, broken down. This is probably the most difficult and complex technology that any of us have ever tried to deal with. And thus, I think that it would mean that we had really given up.
May I ask you one other question? Would you say it is now at least theoretically possible to place a bomb in a satellite and eject it where and when desired?
No, I don't think that's possible at the present time at all.
Is it theoretically possible?
I think it could be possible at some time in the future.
Mr. Finney.
Just one quick question on that point, then, Dr. Glennon. We have made the banning of an orbital bomber one of the key points in our disarmament program. Are we just dealing with a hypothetical situation, then, in our disarmament proposal?
No, I don't think so. If I understand your question correctly, Mr. Finney, we have said we do not want outer space used for anything except peaceful purposes. That calls for a ban of the use of outer space for the launching of bombs were this at some time in the future to be a possibility.
To shift over to your Tyro satellite, your agency has just released some of the pictures taken over the Soviet Union. Can you tell us what recognizable land features those pictures show of the Soviet Union?
We have only a few of these. As you probably know, Mr. Finney, the material that came in from Hawaii came in only on Friday night and has just been processed. I happen to have one that does show a Lake Baikal, which is a large lake near the Mongolian border. That's about the extent of it. I think we do have some pictures, too, that show the island of Hokkaido, one thing another like that. But they're very much like the pictures which we've shown thus far of the St. Lawrence and the Mediterranean.
Well, from your analysis of the pictures thus far, does it seem that Tyros is going to pick up photographic information which will be of military reconnaissance value?
It does not.
I see. It is apparent, however, it seems to me, that Tyros is ushering in the day when satellites are going to be used to spy on the territory of another nation. In your opinion, what is the right of one nation to use satellites to peek into the backyard of another nation?
That, Mr. Finney, is beyond my competence. I have no responsibility for reconnaissance in a military sense. You'll have to speak to the military.
You're one of our leaders here in the space program, Dr. Glennon. Would you have any objection to the Soviet Union putting a military reconnaissance satellite over our nation?
They can get the information they need about our nation very much more easily just by reading your newspaper, Mr. Finney.
One further question on Tyros. When Mr. Khrushchev was here last fall, he presented President Eisenhower with a model of the payload the Soviet Union put on the moon. I wonder if there are any plans now for President Eisenhower to present Mr. Khrushchev with an album of photographs of the Soviet Union taken by an American satellite.
It might be an idea. I don't know of one, but we ought to take that into consideration.
I wonder if you might propose that to President Eisenhower.
I'll tell him that you've suggested it.
Mr. Hines.
Dr. Glennon, you said a few minutes ago that, in your opinion, it was not now possible and would be sometime in the future before it was possible to eject an atomic bomb from an orbiting satellite and bring it down to hit a target. Now, if you're so pessimistic about this, why are you so optimistic about being able to bring a man back from space and bring him into a designated target area?
Because we bring the whole mechanism back from a rather low orbit at the present time. The Mercury project, as you know, Mr. Hines, is intended to orbit at only 120 miles. We have a blunt body which ballistically ought to come back where we expect it to come back. We will have tried this many times before we ever let an astronaut go in it. Thus, I think that one says that at the present state of the art, we think we can bring that kind of a body back, but I'm not sure that anybody would shoot a missile out of one of them.
Well, now I'd like to ask you a few more questions about the Mercury astronaut program. One of them relates to the approximate time of the first Redstone shot. I understand you're going to put a man up about 100 miles up and 100 miles out, bring him back to Earth sometime this year. Can you give us a little closer fix on that time?
No, I think not, Mr. Hines. We have said consistently that we will not attempt a manned flight until we are as certain as possible of the reliability of the various systems and subsystems that are involved in the Mercury package. The way the program is presently going, we feel fairly confident that late this year, we'll be able to attempt the training flight of the astronaut on the nose of a Redstone missile.
Can you tell whether the astronaut who takes the first training flight is likely to be the astronaut who takes the first flight in orbit around the Earth?
I wouldn't have the slightest idea.
Well, what would be the sense of a training flight if the man wasn't to be trained for something else?
I think what we're attempting here is to find out whether the man can do a useful job in this 5 or 6 minutes of weightlessness, whether indeed there are any really significant problems in having him take a longer flight around the world. Besides which, Mr. Hines, we do hope that we will have the ability perhaps to put 4 or 5 men into one of these. I should withdraw that and say allow 4 or 5 of them to have these training flights.
I realize, Dr. Glennon, that your whole agency is trying to pile assurance upon assurance to make a safe voyage for the man. But what do you think is likely to be the effect on the whole man in space program if very early in the game one of these men gets tragically killed?
Well, I think we will certainly be a downhearted group of people, but progress is something that is not made on one single flight. One tragedy could not stop this program, in my opinion. We would simply go ahead. The other astronauts would almost require that we do, as a matter of
fact. Dr. Vannevar Bush, who headed the whole scientific operation of the government during World War II, made the statement just the other day to the House Space Committee that man in space is a stunt. I'm not saying that Dr. Bush's statement is justified, but if it is justified, would you be able to pull off 2 such stunts that would end tragically?
In the vernacular, that's an iffy question. I know Dr. Bush very well. I think that I understand his concern here. I respect him very highly indeed. Dr. Bush, if you read the article or read the statement, went on to indicate that he was as certain as anybody else that in time a man would make this kind of travel through space. What he was saying was that he didn't think it was the first thing to be done. It just so happens that in our program, all of the other activities that we are undertaking tend to underwrite this experiment in sending a man into space. And it does give life and importance to the task that the entire team in NASA is doing.
Mr. Hackus.
There have been many a scientist and people in government and various agencies who criticized NASA, Dr. Glennon, for not trying, instead of putting a Mercury man in orbit, going ahead rather on a vehicle which can be navigated by the man within the vehicle, that is steered into orbit and can do useful tasks, a follow-on to the X-15, perhaps a dinosaur or something of that nature. How do you justify the fact that you are spending so much time and so many millions of dollars just to get a man into a rather short orbit, and that's the end of that, then he comes back?
I think one takes first things first. We believe that the way to get on with this business is to push the state of the art only to a reasonable extent. We know a good bit about blunt bodies and the ballistic trajectories which those bodies follow. We know a good bit about the dissipation of heat from a blunt body coming back into the atmosphere. I think it's a very simple problem of doing the thing which you are reasonably certain you can do reducing the number of variables, and in the meantime, going ahead with the more esoteric job as a follow-on.
Couldn't you just do more or less the same thing by sending a man up and down in a rocket if he went high enough and far enough?
I suppose this would be the case, but I don't think we'd gain anything particularly by that over putting him in orbit. We think we can do this. We think it's an important thing to do it, and we will continue it.
There's also been some criticism of your agency for not including a manned trip to the moon within this decade. I notice you mention it in your report as something that will perhaps take place in the early 1970s. There are those who feel that Russia will be on the moon, perhaps by the 50th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution or some other date. That comes in 1967. Where are our plans to speed up this program and perhaps get there first? Isn't this an important factor?
You know, Mr. Hackus, the simplest way to answer all these questions is to put down a list of all the things that everybody wants and say, now, these are our objectives. It's a lot harder, a lot more difficult, to lay out a sensible program and then try to work that program as diligently and with as much urgency and common sense as we can. If indeed our progress allows us in 1968 to make this voyage to the moon, we'll do it. It just happens to be our judgment that it's going to take a little longer than that.
Mr. Spivak.
Doctor, is it a scientific fact now beyond question that in our lifetime, we will be able to get a man to the moon and back? Is there any question, any scientific question anymore? We all take it for granted now that someone will go to the moon and back.
I think there are questions, there are problems yet to be solved. One of the interesting parts of this business is that I find among the people who are most interested in it that they never have any questions about failure. Optimism, I guess, is a basic ingredient in any research and development program, Mr. Spivak. But there are problems. We don't know as much about the radiation belts as we ought to know and will know before men go through them. There are just any number of questions of this kind that must be answered, and that's why our program has such a very, very broad base in it, where we are attempting to find out as much as we can about the radiation fields, magnetic fields, gravitational fields, micrometeorites in space. You'll note that every one of our probes or our satellites carries equipment which seems to be over and over again taking the same sort of information. This is a fact. We are taking the same sort of information because it may change with time and with latitude and that sort of thing.
Well, the question I'm raising, we've all begun to take it for granted now that someone is going to the moon sooner or later and coming back. Now, do we know enough scientifically now to be able to say that that is a certainty, that sooner or later, if not in our lifetime shortly, someone will go to the moon and come back?
Well, I have no question of this. I think that this will be done, just as men for decades attempted to climb Mount Everest. Someone got there finally.
Yes, but is this a hope on your part, or do we know enough scientifically now to be able to say that this is going to happen, certain to happen?
It's a conviction on my part. I simply say that there is a very great deal of information that must yet be found out before it will be done. But I am convinced, I'm optimistic about our finding out that information.
Do you think we would be able to work this out faster if the Russians and the Americans worked together on this plan?
I don't know that we'd work it out any faster, but I think we might do a better job. This is, strangely enough, one of the areas which interests me most, that in the space business, we have, I think, perhaps a new mechanism for international cooperation, which we ought to push just as hard as we can.
Well, have you or has anybody in the United States proposed to the Russians that we work on this one project together of getting a man to the moon and back?
No, we have not, Mr. Spivak.
Would you like to see this happen?
Yes, I would like to see this happen. I did make a proposal in a speech which was covered by a letter to the Russians, offering them the use of, or offering to provide to them information from our tracking stations for whatever man in space program they might have. They responded saying that this was an offer which they were grateful for, and they, if they needed it, they'd make use of it.
You think this can be because they're far ahead of us?
No, I don't think so.
Mr. Finney.
On this angle of international cooperation, what plans do you have with these weather satellite pictures to give them to the Soviet Union? Will you give all of them to the Soviet Union?
Surely.
Do you have any specific plans to do this?
Oh, we're not going to wrap them up in a bundle and send them to them, no. This, whatever information is put out on Tyros will undoubtedly go through the World Meteorological Organization, of which the Soviet Union is a member.
I'd like to go to your budget, Dr. Glennon. Last year, the Democratic Congress cut your budget by about 6%, giving you $500 million. What effect did this cut have in slowing down our space program?
Well, it required us to make some decisions with respect to particular projects which would be reduced in support. In a situation of that kind, one most often takes the long-range project and reduces that and says, well, we'll pick this up a year from now. This was the case with the F-1 engine, for instance, which we reduced by some $6 million. This probably slowed it down. I think somebody used a figure of 12 to 18 months. I don't really know what it would be, but my guess is perhaps more nearly 6 months.
Well, now, there's a report circulating on Capitol Hill that the House Appropriations Committee is about to cut your budget for the coming fiscal year. Your requested $915 million by 4%. If such a cut were made, would it have a harmful impact upon our space program?
Most certainly, Mr. Finney. We don't play at putting budgets together. That is a serious request. It, in my opinion, is a tight budget in the sense that we have not provided for a lot of extra money that would help us were we to have a failure in some particular element in our program. No, it would hurt us.
Mr. Hines.
Dr. Glennon, I'd like to go back to follow up on Mr. Spivak's question about the joint effort. His question was directed to joint efforts between the Soviet Union and the United States. Do you think perhaps our space dollar would go farther if we had a joint effort between the military and civilian ends of the space business in the United States?
I doubt at the present time whether this would be the case, actually. We do have, of course, a very well-articulated effort with as between NASA and the military. They are pursuing a series of projects which they believe will allow them to do a particular task in space better than they can do it in some other medium.
Now, some time ago, on this same program, Chairman McCona, the Atomic Energy Commission, a member of the Space Council at that time, said that he favored a single, coordinated, civilian-dominated space agency, including military applications. How do you feel about this same thing?
I do not favor that. This is the essence of democracy. We each state our own point of view. I feel rather strongly that the way we are organized presently is perhaps the best, at least for the present time.
Mr. Hackes.
Dr. Glennon, when you launch your future Tyros satellites, I'm told they will include infrared sensors.
Yes.
Is this not the beginning of something that will produce militarily useful pictures, detail on the ground?
Now, what we're going to use the infrared sensors for is to determine the heat balance of the Earth.
I realize that. I've also heard that the CIA would like very much to be included in the planning of your next Tyros launching. Is there any conjunction between you and CIA? Are you working either with each other or against each other?
We are operating a program in space exploration. The CIA is
not
involved in this.
But they're very much interested in your pictures, are they not?
I should think they would be. I should think any governmental agency would be. I should think any American would be interested in these pictures. They are really a significant accomplishment.
And yet you say the pictures are not classified. Why was it so long before we were allowed to see them? They were at least handled on a classified basis. Why was that?
No, let's be reasonably certain that we're both talking about the same thing. As rapidly as we could get pictures processed, they were released. The high-resolution pictures, which is what you're talking about, the camera which looks at an area 80 miles on a side is against the wide angle, which looks at an area 800 miles on the side. We wanted to take a look ourselves and determine whether or not there was a problem in this area in reconnaissance. It is clear that there isn't. I would say to you, Mr. Hackus, had we had a camera in there which would give us reconnaissance information, we would probably take that camera out. We're in the scientific business. We're not in the reconnaissance business.
One further thing occurs to me.
I'm afraid we wouldn't have a chance to ask your question or get an answer. I'm very sorry to have to interrupt, but I see that our time is up.
Our thanks to Dr. T. Keith Glennon and the members.